Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's the 10th
day of the 7th month of 2025. Good morning and welcome to the MoneyWeb Now podcast with Simon Brown. I'm Duduzi Leramela in for Mr. Brown this morning. Here's what you can look forward to. Kia Nonyana of Scope Prime speaks to us about inflation targeting and recent movements in the oil price. Andrew Amolis of New World Wealth discusses South Africa's wealth landscape following the shutting down of a wealth tax by the finance minister. And JD Hayward of Flagship Asset Management shares insights on the outlook for defense stocks. This podcast is brought to you by Standard Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines. Urgent court action aims to end employment equity quotas. Business Day, and that's MoneyWeb. Just by the way, Business Day. South African car makers under scrutiny over safety concerns. Morning markets, US markets, the S&P 500 up 0.61%. NASDAQ closing at a record high on Wednesday at 0.9%, driven by a rally in technology stocks that saw AI chip maker Nvidia briefly hit a $4 trillion market capitalization for the first time. Commodities, gold futures, 3,317, Brent 7017, Platinum 1367, Palladium 1138, the Rand is trading at 1779 to the dollar, Bitcoin 111,105, top 40 opening call expected 191 points in the positive.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
At its meeting in May, the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee published a 3% inflation target scenario, declaring it more attractive than the current 4.5 target. Speaking in Parliament yesterday, the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, told members of Parliament that work, and I quote, is in progress well on the proposed lower inflation target, close quote, and that it needs to be clarified that this policy responsibility resides with the Minister of Finance, who sets the target in consultation with the South African Reserve Bank. And so when it comes to inflation targeting, what is it that we need to understand? Well, Kia Nonyana is with Scope Prime and he joins us this morning to take a look at that. Thank you very much, Kia, for your time this morning. So there's a widely held view of the higher inflation rate, the higher the interest rate a country must have. What is the opposite of that?
Yeah, I think we just need to go back and understand where this inflation target has started. And I think it's in the early 2000s where there was a breakout in inflation. And essentially, it was introduced to setting a range between 3 to 6 for consumer price. And around 2017, the soft shifted that targeting to the midpoint of our 4.5%. Since then, the bank has aimed to target towards that midpoint. And essentially, as the minister was saying, that it essentially is his policy directive in consultation with the SARB. But I mean, even when the SARB decided in 2017 to move that target into the midpoint, there was not a lack of consultation between the minister and the SARB. It was almost an autonomous decision by the SARB governors to target the midpoint. So now I ask myself the question right now, is this 3% anchor going to be achievable without hiking rates? And there's a different couple of scenarios that I've played out in my mind with that.
What are those scenarios?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, usually when you think about inflation, people often say that high inflation induces high investment into that region. And essentially, I mean, I've looked at a lot of the data, a lot of countries with high investment rates, meaning gross fixed capital formation at close to 25%, relatively have lower inflation, which really boasts well. But now the other question, which is the other scenario, is what is going to be the sacrifice ratio for us to achieve it? Because there are going to be short-term impacts. Listening to one of the economists out of the SARB, they say that the short-term implications do not really matter if the long-term gains means more price stability and really more More stability in terms of fiscal spending on interest payments for the government. So I really am in two minds about this inflation targeting moving towards 3%.
You speak of the sacrifice ratio, and I'm quite curious. For the sake of time, maybe let's look at the cost of it. Is there a cost that would be attached to transitioning from the current target to 3%?
The SOB says it's not such a big cost, and I think it's not such a big cost because of the fact that we have little to no growth right now. But for me, the real cost is when we look at the primary mandate of the SOB, it is to maintain price stability in the interest of balanced, sustainable economic growth. So you can't say that because there's a short-term cost because of the fact that there's little to no growth in the economy, that there is no cost. There is a cost because with low growth comes high unemployment, comes as well as going into socioeconomic issues such as hunger, which has been seen on the rise in South Africa. So, I mean, these are the primary costs that we're going through. We have really stringent and tight rates in comparison to other developed nations and developing nations, which means essentially they've almost strangled the economy to a halt with these high interest rates at the SOB. But for them, it seems like it's a sunk cost, which I don't believe it is.
Let's take a look at the oil price.
Yeah, so I think right now, whenever I speak to MoneyWeb now, there's always something new with oil. And the last time we were speaking, we were thinking that oil is going to consolidate around these areas, but new developments have come around with the fact that there's been renewed attacks on the shipping in the Red Seas and worry about the U.S. tariffs on copper and technical short covering on the US on the oil price, which has essentially moved it to the highest since the 23rd of June. And I think that with the US producing less oil in 2025 than previously expected, you will see that the consolidation basis will be here, even though it's a bearish consolidation. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, we were looking at at anticipated price of $110 per barrel. For it to be at $70, you can see that the geopolitical risk premium has kind of subsided.
Kia, I just want to go back to inflation. You mentioned the sacrifice ratio. Can you break that down for our listeners?
The sacrifice ratio is for every interest rate hike, how much does that curtail in economic growth prospects? So essentially, if we're going to keep our interest rates as restrictive as they are, doesn't that mean lower growth? And for me, that is essentially where we are because of the fact that when we look at the estimates from the SOB as well as the Fiscus, the National Treasury, we are set to grow at little just over 1%. But if we keep the interest rates as restrictive as they are, combined with the fact that we have these US tariffs, how much more are we going to give in that economic growth? As muted as it is, it's still growth. And looking at a population rise as much as we have at close to about 4%, we need as much growth as we can so that GDP per capita does not come down and living standards come down for each and every citizen in the economy. So for me, that sacrifice ratio is still too high, even though the SOB sees it as negligible.
Thank you so much for your time this morning. Kia Nonyana is with Scope Prime.
Give you money smoother returns with STANLIB Asset Management. The STANLIB Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
In a report published by Business Tech, the finance minister, Enoch Godongwana, is said to have, quote, shut down calls for a wealth tax and an apartheid-era redress tax, noting that South Africa already taxes the rich heavily. Those in favor of the tax argue it could add billions to the fiscus. So who are the wealthy in South Africa that are caught slap-bam in the middle of this debate, and how are they taxed? Andrew M. Oils is head of research at New World Wealth. He joins us on the line for more. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for your time this morning. So how are the wealthy defined or measured in South Africa?
Well, in our Africa Wealth Report that we do with Henley and Partners annually, which is actually coming out in a couple of months, the new one, we define it as someone with liquid wealth of over 1 million US dollars. So that's liquid wealth of over around 17 million rand. And there are around 40,000 of those individuals living in South Africa. So I'd imagine those would be the 40,000 that they would be looking at in terms of a wealth tax.
Okay. So in South Africa also, we'll get into the wealth tax in a few moments. There's always reference to the so-called 1%. And with that 1%, we're also made to understand that it comes with a certain level of income. So with the work that you do, the 1% that we're referring to, how should we understand it?
The 1% was mainly a measure that was done in the US because about 10, 15 years ago, the 1% in America was the same as all the millionaires. They were the same. So there was 1% of the population were millionaires. Now in the US, about 3% of the population are millionaires. So in South Africa, though, it's only about 0.1%. of the population are millionaires. So it's it differs from country to country. Mm-hmm. Like in Switzerland, it's like 5%, about 5% of the population are millionaires. Mm-hmm. So I think the 1% was really something that was very relevant in the US about 15 years ago, because it was the same as the millionaires. But I think it's not actually particularly relevant in South Africa.
Fair enough. When we speak about the wealth tax, before we go into lessons we can draw from other countries, what is the current stance or feel when it comes to the wealth and them being taxed? The finance minister says, well, we're taxing the wealthy enough.
Well, I think one of the big problems and one a thing that's very rarely discussed is just the social contract that exists, the invisible social aid contract that exists between high-paying taxpayers and the government. I think countries like Australia, for instance, where there's a very strong social contract and people believe that their tax money is being spent wisely, mm-hmm. you could probably maybe get away with a wealth tax. I think in South Africa it would be difficult. I mean, you look at Eskom, for example, it seemed like the more money they threw at it, the worse it got. So I think the idea that if you give more money in tax, the country is going to get better, that isn't necessarily the case. And South Africans are quite skeptical of that. So I think that you've got to have a very strong social contract between the high-paying taxpayers and the government for a wealth tax to work.
I was actually going to ask you about international examples, but then I guess the example that you just alluded to now, it doesn't matter where it is in the world. We should just understand it in terms of this invisible social contract. If the country works, I'm happy to contribute. If it doesn't, then I worry about where the money is going.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Australia's in a way not the best example because they don't actually have a wealth tax, and they actually don't have a state duty either, which is kind of a wealth tax on death. Whereas they have a state duty here. So Australia's actually got much lower taxes than South Africa, but they do have a strong social contract. The countries that have wealth taxes, there's only a few. Norway has one. They've also got a very strong social contract. Spain has got one. France used to have one. But if you look at all those countries, they're currently losing high net worths to migration. So you could argue that their wealth tax haven't worked, because if it's causing wealthy people to leave, then you probably will pull in less money. I think one of the biggest problems, though, with a wealth tax and the reason it doesn't work is the admin involved. It's very, I mean, essentially, you've got to value each person's assets annually. So it's a huge amount of admin for the individual. They've got to obviously have tax advisors and accountants to do it. And then also for SARS, it would be a massive amount of work. Because if you look at on estate duty, when somebody passes away, you have to value all their assets, mm-hmm. and it's a huge job. It takes sometimes 6 to 8 months. They'd have to do that every year, essentially, on the person. So it's not as easy as income, where you just get a PAYE slip and they can just deduct it. There's a lot of things that wouldn't be accounted. It would be a huge amount of admin, and I think that's one of the biggest problems with wealth taxes, is why they haven't really worked.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for your time this morning. Andrew M. Oils is Head of Research at New World Wealth.
The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Love them or hate them, there's a strong positive outlook for the defense sector. This as global military spending is expected to mount. The telltale signs are there, from Operation Midnight Hammer to the Rearm Europe Plan, a package of measures that aims to boost EU defense spending by 800 billion euros over a period of 4 years. There is a shift. Seismic or not, there's a shift. J.D. Hayward is flagship portfolio management asset manager. He believes geopolitical crises and structural shifts in global security architecture are presenting unprecedented opportunities in defense stocks. He joins us now to take a look at this in depth. Thank you very much for your time this morning, JD. How should we understand defense stocks historically as opposed to what we're seeing right now?
Good morning, Lydia. That's a good starting point. So I think the first thing to really comprehend here is that typically we've seen some cyclical drivers for defense stocks. You know, there's always been this ebb and flow between peace and wartime, which can lead to almost cyclical booms and busts for the outlook for that industry. This is also true currently, where we've got, you know, a number of geopolitical flashpoints across the globe. It's quite a volatile security environment. You know, we've got Russia, Ukraine, and China and the South China Sea situation, the Middle East. You know, the U.S. involvement or involvement in Iran looked like it might lead to a much larger regional war, but thankfully that did not happen.
Yeah.
But the big differentiator today is that you've got, aside from those cyclical drivers, you've got structural drivers. And I mean, this is due to decades-long structural underinvestment in defense in the West, particularly in Europe, basically due to what you know, was known as the long peace. And it was a period where they benefited from a peace dividend. You know, they could spend, instead of spending money on, you know, security, they could spend money on social welfare programs, etc. But we're now entering a period of European rearmament. And I think it's quite important to understand just some history here. Mm-hmm. The 2% pledge of, you know, GDP spend by European countries had come all the way back in 2006. But by 2014, only three countries had met that level of contribution. That increased sixfold to 18 countries in 2024. You know, so it's a big difference. But currently, we are looking at that 2% GDP being up to 5%, you know, that is a massive step change. Hmm. So the structural driver is definitely alive at the moment.
Sure. Let's look at some stocks that you profiled in your thought piece. There are some obvious ones, and then there's ones where you wouldn't even think that they play in this space. Let's start with Rolls-Royce, and you can give us sort of like a profile in terms of their offering in this space.
Yeah, sure. So we've got currently four stocks within the sector, not purely defense plays. So you can either do direct militarily, you know, something like a Rheinmetall, a Leonardo. You can do sort of adjacent services, things like sensors and radars, or diversified companies, something like a Rolls-Royce, for example. So Rolls-Royce, you know, it's for starters, it's got nothing to do with the cars in this situation.
Sure.
It's basically engines for aircraft, right? So it's most well known for their civil aerospace business, but they've also got quite a large presence in the defense sector. Now, I mean, the driver for that is as well as the nuclear, you know, nuclear submarine engines, things like that. Mm-hmm. So quite a large part of their business does have this structural growth story behind it.
I just wanted to maybe just on Rolls-Royce, what kind of investor is the stock for? Somebody who's in it for the long term, short term?
No. So we've held, for example, we've held Rolls-Royce since inception. It's returned more than 106% for us. So we're certainly long-term investors in this. Rolls-Royce has been a bit of a turnaround story over the last 3 years or so, you know, a self-help situation where they had some engine troubles a few years ago. That's been rectified and now currently on you know, quite a good foot. Then along with the structural drivers. So no, definitely a long-term holding for us.
Okay. You did mention Rheinmetall as well. Just a little bit of a profile on them and what kind of investor this would attract.
Yeah, so Rheinmetall is a German defense contractor. They produce proper military, you know, munitions. Quite an expensive stock at this stage. It's had an extraordinary run given Germany's commitment to upping their defense spending, basically. But I mean, I think with all of these stocks, you need to be careful to some extent of the valuation levels. But I think all of these stocks have a structural growth story behind them. And that is sort of the message. You know, this isn't a cyclical boom and bust. And while there might be pullbacks from time to time, I mean, the step change in defense spending commitment from NATO members in Europe from 2% to 5%, that's over the next 10 years, so by 2035. I mean, that is a massive runway for growth. And these companies typically only expand when they've got, you know, commitment from governments, committed contracts. So you've got a pretty solid runway for growth. Yeah, not leaving a lot of chance there. Definitely a long-term idea.
Sure. As an investor, JD, how important is it for you to familiarize yourself with the risk, more so with these kinds of stocks?
No, I mean, that's, of course, front and center. You need to be aware of what can go wrong in any of these investment cases. I mean, there's risk from a execution point of view. You know, there's risk from, as I say, the one risk that is sort of mitigated is these companies typically only commit to expansion once they've got committed long-term government contracts. So that risk is sort of mitigated. I guess the other type of risk that you can say these companies have is, you know, the ESG angle on them, where that's obviously not very popular with a lot of investors. So yeah, that's something that you might have to take into account.
Thank you so much for your time this morning, JD Hayward, Flagship Portfolio Management Asset Manager.
This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile markets. Thank you very much for joining us. And that's it from us. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and app at 6:30 a.m. and podcast just after 7 a.m. A big thank you to the team, Eddie, Nobuhle and Nicole. And of course, to you for choosing us and listening. I'm Duduzile Ramelas. And for Simon Brown this morning, thank you very much. And we'll see you again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Listen to the live stream of MoneyWeb Now at the same time every weekday. For more business, finance, and investment news, MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.